Rewind, your week in review, is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.
This program is brought to you from the Margaret Farrow Studio.
This week on Rewind, your week in review. A majority of Wisconsinites say they wanted that surplus deal on property taxes and school funding. But GOP gubernatorial candidate Tom Tiffany stands by his criticisms. And Democrats say they want to tax any money that goes to January 6th defendants. All that and more on Rewind, your week in review for May 29th.
I'm Anya Van Wagtendonk.
And I'm Scott Bauer.
Welcome to Rewind. Thanks so much for filling in this week, Scott.
You bet.
We are continuing this week to talk about the only thing I think that we are now legally allowed to talk about in politics, which is the surplus deal for the third straight week. This week, a poll came out from the Marquette Law School, kind of getting a sense of how voters are feeling about that failed surplus deal. And the big sort of top line figure, stark on the screen right there, is that 80% of Wisconsin wanted this surplus deal to pass. They surveyed 454 adults, and this was split pretty evenly, bipartisanly. Republicans, Democrats, Independents all think that lawmakers should have gone ahead and supported it. They think that governor candidates shouldn't have opposed it. And then even when asked about these projections that it would have blown a $3 billion hole in the state budget, they wanted it anyways. So what do you think this means for November? What is this going to do for voters?
Yeah, a lot to look at here. You know, first of all, it's very, very unusual, as viewers would know and as you know, to have kind of a bipartisan agreement to this level on really anything. So that stands out, number one. Number two, I think there are questions about how much voters really knew about this whole thing. You know, we're kind of in that summertime period. It came about very quickly, came on the floor very quickly, you know, so there wasn't a lot of time for voters to really kind of know what was in this thing and the implications of it. But, you know, so you also wonder whether the people responding to the poll had all the information they needed to make a good judgment, but we'll never really know that, right? So to get into the November part, I think that really the big question is, will voters still care or remember this in November? Or are there going to be other issues that are more important to them when they go to the polls? It seems hard to believe that in however many months from now that someone's going to walk in and say, I'm voting for X because of their position on this bill. It may be a part of the mix that the candidates get into. And, you know, obviously we saw most gubernatorial candidates come out against this plan. Missy Hughes was the rare one who was vocal in support of it. You also had Republican Tom Tiffany lobbying lawmakers against, you know, to vote against it. So there's a lot of kind of interesting dynamics there about what was going on politically behind the scenes. But the poll shows, obviously, that most voters were very much in support of what didn't happen. So there is some room there either to go after somebody about this or to have them have to do some explaining to voters between now and November.
Right. I mean, part of what we saw on the floor during debate is that the supporters could say, I want to put $300 in your pocket or $600 in your pocket, and I want to put money in your schools. And then the critics of it had to give, like, sort of mathematical explanations of why they didn't support it, which is, to quote a JRism, if you're explaining, you're losing. And so it's much harder to kind of prove the negative of if we do pass this, it will create issues down the road, blah, 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 versus like you are feeling the pain right now, $300 in your pocket.
Yes. And I think to the average person, it's really hard to kind of understand and appreciate, oh, this is going to create a $3 billion hole in state government. Like, you hear these huge numbers, you hear these kind of theoreticals all the time. And I think voters just kind of check out. But when they say you could have had a check of $300 or $600, or your school could have gotten more money that would have lowered your property taxes, I think that's a much easier argument for people to understand or to at least like get behind than it is to have the argument of like, well, I'm really concerned about a structural deficit from 3 years from now. That's just so kind of theoretical that people don't really glom onto that.
Right. And sort of one of those fits on a flyer or a mailer a little bit better than the other.
Right.
And so that'll be really interesting to see, you know, when voters say that they will care about this, and that was one of the things that this poll measured for, to what extent will people who are running for office, you know, sort of glom onto it and not let them forget by kind of trying to shove some of these messages down
there. But the interesting thing is, you know, assuming Tom Tiffany is a Republican nominee, which he has really only nominal opposition, and assuming that the Democratic nominee is someone who also came out against this thing, where is the attack? Because they were both on the same side of it, right? So that's where I kind of wonder, like, what is the impact of this going to be? Because they can't go after one another for killing this deal because they were potentially likely both the Democratic and Republican nominee for governor will have opposed it. So that's why I kind of wonder what the legs are on this issue in terms of November. What it does do is set up a really interesting dynamic for the next governor and the next legislature, because now you have this huge pot of money that's still there, that's still unspent, and that next governor and legislature is going to have to decide what to do with it. So you're going to see another version of this kind of argument happening in January, February, March next year, because they didn't do anything with it right now.
Yeah, and maybe voters are kind of primed now to say, oh, that's available to us in a way that, you know, over the last 8 years, Democrats have said, we want to spend the surplus. Republicans have said, absolutely not, unless it's a tax cut. And now there's like this secret third option that has been kind of presented to voters. And so who knows how they're going to feel going into potentially a totally shifted legislature and governor's seat.
As a wise observer of the legislature once told me, it's much harder to deal with a surplus than it is to deal with a shortage. When you have more money, everybody wants a piece of that pie, right? And the tensions on what to do with the surplus are so different from when you don't have enough. When you don't have enough, it's easy to say no, because you just say, we don't have enough. And then you have to make other difficult decisions. But when you have a huge surplus, everybody wants a cut of it. And so everybody's trying to balance that, you know, who gets how much and how do we deal with it. And we've been in that world for a while with the legislature, which is not always the case. And so, you know, as long as the projections hold up and there isn't some dramatic economic shift, there will be this pot to deal with again next year.
I mean, that is a big if.
It is a big if. Yeah.
You mentioned also, you know, Tiffany's opposition to it, and he spoke at this forum and at the With Politics hosted forum this week, and he was asked about that same opposition, and he stood by his opposition, but he said, I would like to give every dollar of the surplus back to taxpayers. Don't worry, I will also still fund schools. A little bit light on specifics, he was then asked about this projection of the deficit, and we had a little bit of video of kind of how he responded to that.
So if we're using Madison math, yes, if you're using Madison math, but that's not how I'm going to approach the governorship. It isn't what's best for Madison first or for state government first. It's what's best for you first, for the people of the state of Wisconsin, the nearly 6 million people. I believe, Jeff, we can do both. We can return money to the taxpayers, including the surplus here, and we can also have a balanced budget. And you do it by setting priorities. Ever since I've been in the legislature, I've divided spending into wants and needs. And you make sure that you spend money on the needs first, and then when you run out, just like a family, then you stop spending.
So Madison math is kind of this phrase that he kept coming back to, this idea that it shouldn't be impossible to both give away the entire surplus as he wants to and then also kind of fund other priorities. But how would that work? And, you know, sort of a reminder that the deal as it was proposed would have been about half for school funding, half for tax relief, roughly. So if you then put all of that towards tax relief instead, direct checks or whatever the case may be, where does the school funding piece come from?
Right. I mean, he kept using that phrase, Madison math, and it wasn't really clear what that was. And I'm not sure I understand what he meant by Madison math. And, you know, look, it's easy to say, I want to give it all back to taxpayers and then not say what you're going to fund and what you're not. Budgets are all about choices. They are all about wants and needs, as he talks about. But he didn't give any details about what he considers the needs and what he considers the wants. And that's for every governor and every legislature. That is what a budget debate is. It's a battle over priorities. It's what do you want to prioritize? What do you want to spend money on? He talked in very general terms about what he wants, but, you know, it's easy to say, I want to fund schools. Well, schools are going to get funding. It's a matter of how much and how it's going to be split up and, you know, who's going to get it and who's not, the winners and losers. That's every budget debate from the beginning of time. So I didn't hear anything from Congressman Tiffany that shed any real light on what he would prioritize. I think, you know, Democrats would point to his record and show, like, over time what he has supported and what he hasn't, just as he would point to what the Democrats have supported and what they haven't. So ultimately what you end up with is, you know, voters are going to have to decide which candidate, what priorities they've made public and what their record shows, you know, what they would support, and then kind of wonder how they would deal with this in their budget unless they come out between now and then with more specific plans. And then even then, after they're elected, there's no guarantee they're going to follow through with what they say they're going to do.
I mean, you know, I think one thing that all governor candidates are kind of contending with is that it is better to be governing with a surplus than a deficit. Maybe it's harder in the legislature, but it's much nicer if you're kind of in the executive room. We were talking a little bit before the show about your coverage of sort of the Walker years and the last time that there was a significant deficit in Wisconsin. Can you talk a little bit about those 2009, 2010, and kind of just what that means for state government to be ruling from a place of deficit?
Yeah, I mean, so as an example, when the recession hit in 2008, the legislature had to come back in and deal with not having enough money to pay the bills, which is kind of the flip side of where we are right now, and had to vote to raise taxes, right? Not just raise taxes because they wanted to raise taxes because there wasn't enough money coming in, or they weren't willing to make the cuts to get to where they needed to get. And this was a Democratic legislature, a Democratic governor. All of that turmoil played into then-Governor Jim Doyle deciding not to seek a third term, Scott Walker running, and Republicans then in 2010 campaigned on these tax increases and the fact that there was this budget deficit shortfall out there. And the Republicans ended up flipping the legislature in 2010. Walker got elected, and along with some other factors, that set the stage for what became Act 10, which Walker proposed on the argument that we have this huge shortfall, we need to deal with that, and here's my plan for dealing with that. Democrats said that was just a red herring and that really he wanted to, you know, cut union power and it really wasn't about the budget and all of that. But, you know, that's the kind of dynamic that gets set up when you're short on money. You can have somebody come in and say, we need to make a dramatic change. When you have a surplus, it's harder to make that argument because people can say, you know, things are going pretty well right now. We just want to give this extra money either back to taxpayers or give schools more or whatever. It seems less likely to have a dramatic shift, but you never know.
Yeah, that's so interesting about sort of the potential long-term consequences, which again, sort of Republican and Democratic opponents were both pointing to as we are entering this period of economic uncertainty. So, you know, why not kind of keep some money in the bank?
I mean, look, the next governor wants to have as much money as possible, and the next legislature wants to have as much money as possible to do with what they want, right? The people who cut this deal are all lame ducks. Governor Evers, Speaker Voss, and Majority Leader LeMahieu. None of them are going to be around next year. None of them are going to be the ones who are going to have to write the next budget. So it's really not surprising that these folks running for governor, other than Missy Hughes, are out there saying, hey, we want to have, I mean, they're not saying it like this, but this is what they're saying. We want to have that money to use it as we want to use it. And I think there are also many lawmakers who look at these projections and say, you know, hey, there may be a recession coming, there may be some economic hard times, and we would rather have this money around to help us deal with that so we avoid what happened in 2008 and 2009 when we didn't have enough money to pay the state's bills.
Also at this event, Tom Tiffany was asked about this new sort of settlement fund for victims of weaponized government or something like this. This is a $1.8 billion settlement in the lawsuit that the Trump family filed against the IRS. And this is essentially a taxpayer-funded fund that could go to January 6th defendants, anybody who sort of identifies as a victim of lawfare. It is, in theory, nonpartisan. It's, in theory, not tied directly to the Biden administration. It's in theory not just for monetary compensation. You could also just like ask for an apology. But so this is a fund that a lot of people are saying could go to defendants of the January 6th case. What do we kind of, before we get into Tiffany's sort of direct response to what he thinks about it, what do we need to know kind of about this fund and what it could or could mean for the various defendants in Wisconsin?
Right. So, I mean, President Trump has proposed creating this fund. There is no mechanism yet to hand the money out. There's no there are no commissioners or people assigned to kind of deal with this whole process. And in fact, you have a legal fight ongoing. I believe earlier today a judge said that there cannot be any payments for now out of this fund that's been created. So really, without being an expert on what's going on there, it just seems like there's a lot of unknowns at this point as to how this is all going to work, or if it's going to work, or if it's going to happen. But it's certainly a political issue that Democrats especially are keying in on for people like Tom Tiffany and others to get them to comment on what they think about it and how they would deal with it or what their thoughts are, which maybe leads into our clip that we have.
not a clip of it,
okay,
but
all right.
He did talk about, you know, the other kind of piece of it is some of the Capitol Police have sued to kind of try to block this as well. And that was kind of Tiffany's response overall. He said that perhaps these defendants could be owed restitution, but he's still studying the details. But he said if they were illegitimately harmed. But one of the ways that he did differ from Donald Trump is that he said anybody who is found to have harmed a law enforcement officer, like, should not get that kind of restitution. And so that's this kind of interesting way that maybe he's trying to thread the needle of he's still quite aligned with Trump, Trump voters, the Trump base, but also, you know, the law enforcement issue is going to be very important to him as he runs this race as
right,
well.
Right. I mean, just a reminder that he is endorsed by President Trump already in the race.
Yeah. And then I have not seen this at a With Politics event before. These are normally slightly quiet affairs at the Madison Club here in downtown Madison. But there were protests outside of this particular one because of comments that Tiffany made recently about saying that the FBI should continue investigating the 2020 election. A reminder that it is the summer of 2026. He did, during this event, confirm that he sort of confirmed that Biden was the president. He said that he served as the president and that he referred to him as the president. But, you know, he was one of the Congress people who did vote to overturn results in Pennsylvania and Arizona. So what do you make of this being an issue in 2026? I've seen some criticism from Republicans saying this is almost an unforced error. You don't need to be talking about this, and this is not a good, maybe this works in the Northwoods, but this is not a good statewide issue.
Yeah, I mean, what you see here is President Trump is continuing to talk about 2020, continuing to go into states that were swing states that he lost and trying to relitigate what happened in 2020. So I think what that does is it puts people like Tom Tiffany in somewhat of a box because he's endorsed by the president. He was one of those who, as you referenced, voted to decertify results from two states, and he had actually said that he would have voted not to accept Wisconsin's results had he had that opportunity. So that is definitely going to be an issue that Democrats raise. And as much as Tom Tiffany may not want to talk about 2020 because Donald Trump is still talking about it and because the FBI is in Wisconsin talking with election officials, Tom Tiffany is continuing to have to confront this issue and thread that needle where he said, you know, Joe Biden was president, I called him president. That doesn't answer the question of do you think he won? It just says he was the president, right? So that's kind of the de facto answer that a lot of people give, a lot of Republicans give when they're asked about the problems in 2020. And he also talked about some issues that he saw in the election in 2020 that is kind of part of this whole universe of, you know, trying to raise doubt about what happened, even though there have been innumerable lawsuits, investigations, audits, reviews that have shown no major problems in 2020 in Wisconsin with the vote. And yet here we are, as you said, 6 years later, still talking about it.
Yeah. And another way that is kind of continuing is that, speaking of this, the weaponization fund, Dianne Heselbein and Democrats have introduced a bill, the No Taxpayer Dollars for Insurrectionists Act. And so essentially this would put a 100% Wisconsin state income tax on any payouts received from this slush fund, they call it. Put simply, if you are from Wisconsin and you stormed the Capitol, you will not receive money from the slush fund. So, you know, obviously we're not in a legislative session right now. So the likelihood of this kind of moving forward in a literal legislative sense, not likely. But what are Democrats kind of trying to message here?
I mean, it's a great campaign point for them, right? I mean, they can say, we have a bill that will do exactly what you just said, and they can talk about that as their kind of reaction to what's going on. But again, it's a campaign talking point. It's not anything that's close to reality. Obviously, if there's a divided legislature, or if Republicans have control, if there's a Republican governor, this is going nowhere. But if we have Democratic control and a Democratic governor, you know, there's this bill out there that they're going to be campaigning on and talking about. And so that would, you know, potentially be something that gets talked about next year. And it's not just in Wisconsin. I mean, we've seen this nationally and in other states where Democrats are bringing this up. So you know, it's definitely it gives them a counterpoint and it gives them something to argue with voters, saying, "See, look, this is our response to what's going on." You know, so it can appease those on the left who are wondering what the reaction is going
to
be.
Yeah, I'll be interested to see how the sort of Democratic gubernatorial candidates respond. I saw Mandela Barnes put out a statement kind of agreeing with taxing it, and maybe some others did as well. One of the big open questions here in Wisconsin, there are, I counted right before this, I think 11 people from Wisconsin who are kind of active defendants in J6-related cases as of a little while ago. But kind of the biggest name here is Jim Troupas, who was the Trump campaign lawyer in 2020. He's considered one of the architects of the false electors scheme. He settled a civil case a little while ago. He's under now a felony case, a felony forgery case that is ongoing. You and I have covered, I think, all the many twists and turns, and we will continue to do so. And he is reportedly asking for $3.2 million from the fund. He's been saying for a really long time that this has essentially ruined his life and his family's life. He's a victim of sort of lawfare. And I think he's one of the first people to make this formal ask, as far as we can tell.
Right. He's one of the first that we know of. And again, going back to my earlier point, we don't know how this is all going to play out and, you know, what kind of process there will be. But we do have him now publicly out there. This letter is out there with him making this request, which, again, you know, will become a campaign point for folks on the left. You know, they'll certainly point to it and say, do you want $3.2 million going to this guy who worked on this whole thing? And those on the right will say, look, he was wronged by a system that went after him unfairly. It's only right that he get compensated for what he's been through. So, you know, like it or not, 2020 isn't going away anytime soon. It's going to be an issue throughout this campaign. And this whole fund that the president set up is going to be another, you know, point for everyone to talk about and argue about. And it draws pretty clear lines in the sand, unlike the tax bill we talked about, which has a much murkier kind of political messaging around it.
Yeah. And Troupas is, I believe, scheduled to be arraigned in June in that same forgery case, along with Mike Roman and Ken Jesbrow, another Wisconsinite. That brings us to a tiny little update in a very big case that I realized we were off the air when this case was filed, and so we didn't have a chance to talk about it then. And so I'm going to talk about it a little bit in depth now, even though it was technically filed in February. So this is the Wisconsin PTA versus the legislature. So essentially a group of PTA, teachers unions, parents, students suing the Wisconsin State Legislature, saying that the school funding apparatus at the Capitol violates the Constitution that says that students will receive an adequate and nearly uniform public education. So the arguments in this case are essentially that school funding is too low, it hasn't kept pace with inflation, it doesn't keep up with sort of newer educational needs, that districts are increasingly turning to referendums, that poorer districts kind of can't keep up with that because they can't use that same system. And so therefore, educational opportunity now varies dramatically based on zip code. So the latest hearing on this, and it was sort of like a small procedural thing, but it was in Eau Claire yesterday, I believe, and you watched that hearing take place.
I did, yeah. So they that hearing essentially was an argument about whether the school choice folks could intervene in the lawsuit. So a legal question. But one of the things that caught my attention was the judge said, look, I have a kid in public school currently. I had other children who went through Eau Claire Public Schools. And my child is involved in activities that one of the plaintiff's child is also involved in. I know the family. I don't want to put words in the judge's mouth, but the impression was that they were not close, but she knew who they were. And she also made the point of saying, I'm active in the community. I'm generally aware of the public schools. You know, I'm a member of the Eau Claire community. Does anyone want me to recuse from the case? And the attorneys on this hearing said, you know, for this particular issue, which is a very fairly narrow issue of whether, you know, these folks ought to be allowed to intervene or not, no one objected. But again, the judge reiterated toward the end, hey, guys, before we get any further in this, please let me know if you want me to step aside in this case. So that remains an open issue. What it really means is there's another potential for delay there, especially for folks who may want to, you know, slow this thing down. They may ask for a new judge, and then you kind of start all over with that. And it's in the very early stages here, but it's certainly one to watch, and it's certainly one that no matter what judge at the circuit court level gets it, and no matter what they rule, that is not going to be the end of this lawsuit. It's going to the state Supreme Court.
Yeah, I mean, that's part of why I wanted to make sure that we discussed it, is that it really has the potential to be a landmark decision in Wisconsin. And one of the reasons that school choice voucher schools were requesting to intervene is that they say essentially changing the formula will then have these kind of domino effects on how their schools are funded. And so there's a lot of different players. I think also this question of recusal, you know, it's just a reminder that public schools are themselves politicized, right? And so even just the act of having children in a certain school could potentially be construed in this political way. And so I think that's a really interesting piece of this. The next kind of step is the motion to dismiss. So there will be a determination in July, I guess, assuming that there's not, you know, some changes to who's the judge. And that is the legislature is essentially arguing that school funding has indeed increased in recent years, that the courts aren't responsible for dictating state budgets, and that the way that the Wisconsin Constitution is words that right to an equal education doesn't talk about funding in any way. And so that'll be really interesting. But there has been successful litigation like this in Washington State, New Jersey, and Kansas, interestingly enough. So it'll be really interesting to see how this plays out similarly to or differently from that. And then also, again, the politics of it. This lawsuit was repeatedly referred to during the debates over the surplus deal. Democrats kept saying, like, hey, man, we got sued over school funding. Maybe we are doing something wrong. And I think, you know, Republican leadership in particular, who are some of the named plaintiffs along with, I'm sorry, some of the named defendants along with the Joint Finance Committee are making these arguments that, you know, it's not really the court's business.
Yeah, I mean, school funding is something that we're always going to be talking about, right? We're always going to be arguing over it. The formula to determine who gets how much is one of the most complicated and least understood functions of state government. You know, maybe Medicaid is up there, is one of the most Byzantine, difficult things to figure out. And that's one of the reasons why over time there's always been calls, redo the formula, you know, make it more fair, do this, that, or the other. But it's so complicated, and it ultimately comes down to a political decision by those in power of, if we make a change, who gets hurt and who gets helped, right? And so, and property taxes are a major part of this conversation because schools rely on property taxes for a big chunk of their funding. And voters are angry that property taxes have gone up dramatically in this year. So, you know, it's not unique to Wisconsin. It's not anything that's going away anytime soon. But this lawsuit is a pivot point that will be really interesting to see how and when this all gets decided.
Yeah. The other thing that we're kind of looking towards is Monday is the deadline for candidates for office to file their signatures. So we know of a couple gubernatorial candidates who have already gotten their signatures in. Kel DeRoys, Joel Brennan. Tom Tiffany said that he signature maxed by getting signatures from all 72 counties, which made me feel incredibly old. So what are we kind of looking towards as these races kind of shape up and finalize?
Yeah, we'll find out who's actually going to be on the ballot, right? There may be some fringe candidates who made a little splash but who don't actually submit the signatures. You know, in the legislative races, too, you'll get a better feel for where we're going to have primaries and where we're going to have, you know, who's going to be running where. I don't think there should be too many surprises on Monday. It's not like somebody's going to drop a bunch of signatures who we didn't know was going to be running. Really what it does, I think, is just it shows you where these primaries are going to be, number one. And then number two, it just the field is solidified in terms of the primary field. So you'll know where the contested races are. You'll know who's going to be on the ballot. And you know, there could be an opportunity to challenge some signatures, so we'll have to go through that process with the Elections Commission. But it's really just the next, I don't want to say pivot point again, but I'm going to say it again. It's the next pivot in the governor's race, the next thing in the election, the next thing to happen. And, you know, it's a significant one.
Yeah, I think one of the things I keep hearing from watchers is that this has been a really sleepy race so far, and people don't seem super excited about many of these candidates. And we are going to summer when people, I think, really just want to go out on boats or whatever. And so we'll see whether that pivot, you know, gives anybody particular momentum. But that'll be something to keep an eye on. And that'll do it for us on Rewind This Week. I am Anjuvan Wagtendonk.
And I'm Scott Bauer.
We'll see you next week.
All right.
This program was brought to you from the Margaret Farrell Studio.
Rewind, your week in review, is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.